We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Getting started with local and the Mercer Beautification Project.
Yeah, this week Mayor McGinn finally admitted on Wednesday that the Mercer Beautification Project didn't really fix the Mercer traffic mess.
Now you should explain that they don't actually call it the Mercer Beautification Project.
Oh, no, but that's what it is. It's the project to turn Mercer Street into a two-way boulevard. I guess it's safe for him now to say that it really, even now that it's almost complete, that it really was never about fixing the Mercer mess, and that taxpayers have spent $164 million really just to make Mercer Street look a little more inviting for developers in South Lake Union. In fact, that's what he said when he was interviewed and asked, well, why did taxpayers spend all that money? He said, well, you know, to bring more investment in South Lake Union.
Except that they got a fair amount of money for that project from the feds, and the feds were pitched on it as a transportation issue.
Yes.
Which is actually most transportation projects in this city, I can think of a tunnel that certainly qualifies for this, are real estate development projects. They're not transportation fixes, which is why our transportation continues to, what's the technical word, suck.
Yes, and so now we know, you know, we have the admission from a public official, one who really helped to push through the Mercer Beautification Project, that yes, that $164 million was spent mainly to benefit Paul Allen and the Vulcan Development Company.
Yeah, and the first clue should have been that Mayor McGinn has really never evinced that much concern with the idea that that cars might have a more difficult time in the city of Seattle. But it also tells you why they raised the height limits on development in South Lake Union. It's because the carbon monoxide from the idling cars doesn't reach quite that high. So for the 20th or 25th story, it's actually okay still.
Yeah, no, it's been bad Mercer traffic in the past 2 weeks. When they talked about fixing the Mercer, the building the new Mercer Boulevard, turning it into a two-way street, the traffic engineers that they consulted said, well, it will speed up traffic westbound on Mercer towards the waterfront, and it will slightly slow down traffic eastbound towards the freeway. And I think that was a gross understatement of what's actually happened, that it's created a big bottleneck eastbound.
Yeah, I was going northbound on, coming out of the Battery Street Tunnel in the middle of the day this week, and saw the traffic, you know, backed up off the exit to, I think it's Broad and Mercer there. And I was thinking, huh, that's funny. I thought Mercer had opened by now. I didn't realize it was still under construction. Well, it has opened, and it's going to be like that moving forward.
I don't know. I could see where it was true that they said it would slightly slow down towards the freeway because it really wasn't moving prior.
No,
and so now
that's
it's not
true.
Moving at all.
Now it's really not moving at all.
So, I don't think that's making things up. All right, anything else on that?
No.
All right, let's move on to the Port of Seattle and their CEO.
Yeah, the latest port scandal. CEO Tei Yoshitani accepted a side job with Expeditors International. Expeditors International is a company that helps port customers with their shipping needs. They help to schedule shipping on shipping lines and that sort of thing. And of course, I thought it was really interesting that all the local media said, well, Expeditors isn't really a port customer, when that's nonsense. Expeditors is absolutely a port customer, and that Yoshitani taking a job on their board for the total pay of about $230,000 a year.
Nice, that's gig a con- if you can get it.
Yeah, that's a conflict of interest, definitely. And of the port commissioners, four of them have weighed in. Bill Bryant still hasn't, but Gail Tarleton and Rob Holland have both asked Yoshitani to resign his position, either resign his position at Expeditors or to resign as port CEO. John Crichton wants outside counsel to review the deal, and Tom Albro has said he thinks it's all okay, particularly because there's a clause in Yoshitani's contract that allows him to serve on the board of a for-profit company. This apparently is extremely unusual. There's no other port director that we know of in the United States who has a clause like that in their contract. And interestingly enough, no one, whether it's the Seattle Times or local blogs or critics of the port, have pointed out that Yoshitani was hired in March of 2007. And who was the senior port commissioner at that time? Well, everybody probably remembers Pat Davis, the woman who brought the WTO to Seattle. During that time period in 2007.
And she was the one also who cut the golden parachute deal for the outgoing.
Yeah, for the outgoing CEO. During that time period in 2007, all of the other port commissioners were really far junior to Pat Davis. Most of them had 2 to 3 years of experience as a port commissioner. Bob Edwards had been on the commission for 7 years. But Pat Davis at that point had been a port commissioner for 21 years. So she really was the one who led the negotiations for Yoshitani's contract and allowed him to insert that clause. And she would have been perfectly fine with this deal, too. So just a little reminder there that you can point the finger at Tei Yoshitani, but let's not forget this is business as usual for the port.
Yeah, one of the reasons maybe this hasn't gotten a lot of media attention locally is that this is, in fact, business as usual. I mean, Maria called it a scandal, but it's standard operating procedure, really, and has been for many, many years. I think I've been saying for close to a couple decades now that the Port of Seattle is flat out the most corrupt public agency in the state of Washington, period, end of story. And part of that culture of corruption is the idea you scratch my back, I scratch yours with port vendors and with people who oversee the port is very, very common. For example, the port has for a number of years off and on had fairly lucrative consulting contracts that it's given to Senator Ed Murray, who has oversight of the regulation of them from his committee position in the Washington legislature. And, you know, when that first came out, that story lasted for about 3 seconds. And again, it's the same thing. You know, the whole idea with the scandal with the previous port commissioner and the huge compensation packages that the CEOs of the port get. They're already among the highest paid port commissioners in the country.
He is the highest paid port commissioner in the country. He gets about $367,000 a year.
And by context, how much do you say he was earning on the board?
About $230,000. And, you know, the head, just for comparison, the head of the New York and New Jersey Port Authority, who oversees 5 seaports, 3 major airports, and commuter rail line, he makes $290,000 a year. So about 70,000-80,000 less than Yoshitani does as CEO of the Seattle port. So that tells you something.
And one of the difficulties is that the Port of Seattle, despite its name, is a King County-wide agency. And so the port commissioners are elected countywide. They're races that often do not get a lot of attention. And the commission positions themselves don't pay a lot. So what you get is that the only people who can afford to run for those races, both because the positions don't pay a lot, and because it costs a lot to run countywide in a position that nobody pays much attention to, tend to be people who are retired or who are motivated because they have experience with or they are directly paid by other industries that do business with the port. And this has been the case over and over and over again. The current slate of port commissioners is slightly better than it's been in the past, but it's still an endemic problem of corruption there and is going to continue to be unless we figure out a way to draw more attention to this stuff.
All right, let's move on. City Council vote this week with Yesler Terrace?
Yeah, City Council voted unanimously to do the rehab project at Yesler Terrace that we talked at some length about last week. Just to recap, they are increasing the number of housing units in Yesler Terrace roughly tenfold, but they're doing so in a way where less than 10% of the units that will be on site in the Yesler project now will actually be dedicated to the very poor that is supposedly the mission of the Seattle Housing Authority to serve. And above and beyond that, half of the development at at Yesler Terrace is now, the property is now going to be sold to private developers, and it's going to go into office space, into retail, and into for-profit development. All of the other housing units.
And what they call market rate.
Well, I was going to get to that. All of the other housing, there is either going to be, mixed income, which is to say, you know, 80% of median income or, right around 100% of median income, or it's going to be market rate, which is the new high-end stuff that you see in the condos and whatnot around town. And it's been really, really revealing that aside from the community activists who've been up in arms about this, the city council voted unanimously on this. Even Nick Licata, who had at the committee level raised a number of amendments, most of which did not pass, but a few of the more toothless ones did, and probably in exchange for support on those amendments, he had to trade off that he would vote for the final package, which was a fait accompli at that point anyway. But this project has probably been secured behind the scenes for at least a year or two, long before the public hearings were held, long before even the details were made public. And this, again, it seems like an enormous betrayal of the Seattle Housing Authority's mission, but outside the residents themselves and housing advocates and a handful of other people, nobody's been really making that point that once again, as with the Port of Seattle and its development on the waterfront and so forth, you've got yet another local agency, and other City of Seattle departments have been like this too, the Parks Department, that seem to be more concerned about for-profit income streams than they do actually meeting their original mission. And in this case, the need is enormous. There's a far greater demand for affordable housing for working class people in Seattle than there is housing available. New housing of that sort is not being built. In fact, the Yesler Terrace is when they could have obviously added quite a bit of stock of low income housing, given that they're increasing the overall stock by tenfold from what's on site now. Instead, they're actually reducing the amount that's on site. The rest of the people that need to have their units replaced are being moved off site to a different area that doesn't have a nice view, quite as nice a view. Yeah. Frankly,
that's how it's really been talked about in the local press too. Just article after article and commentary after commentary about how isn't this great? They're going to redevelop all this land so close to downtown. It's too bad the poor have had their hands on this for so long.
Yeah, the poor didn't have their hands on it. The city of Seattle had their hands on it, and the city of Seattle made a determination that. That housing people who needed public assistance in order to find affordable housing was a priority for the taxpayers and the citizens of the city of Seattle. That apparently is no longer a priority, and making money for developers is a higher priority.
And that's actually been the case for at least the last 20 years, that that the city of Seattle's new policy has been to push the poor out of the city entirely as much as possible.
And it's worked.
All right. Let's move on to national and the Democratic National Convention.
Yeah, 1 week after the Republican Convention in Tampa, the Democrats met in Charlotte this week. There weren't a lot of surprises at the Democratic Convention, of course. We knew exactly going in who was going to be nominated and what people were going to say about them. But it was very interesting to see how different the tone and the coverage of the convention was. In part, frankly, that was because the Democratic Convention had much better speakers in a lot of cases, and speakers that, by and large, tend to be somewhat tethered to reality. Whether you support them or not, they at least weren't talking about things like dinosaurs or roaming the earth with human beings 6,000 years ago. But it really was very interesting to see that the nature of these conventions has really changed, and the changing media landscape over the last decade or two has really changed the way in which news about the conventions gets out. So you had much more enthusiasm, at least among mainstream media and among supporters for the Democratic convention, in part because in the past, particularly for people who didn't follow politics closely, the conventions and then the last few weeks of the campaign were major sources of information for people about who the candidates were, what they stood for, et cetera. As they've become elaborate infomercials, basically, for the candidates, there's been less of that sort of information, and correspondingly also less media coverage from the mainstream media, also because there's less news being made because it's so scripted these days, unless you're Clint Eastwood with a chair. But the other piece of it is that there's a lot more information out there now because of this little thing that some Republicans apparently haven't heard of called the Internet. And so what winds up getting attention is not so much what the networks decide is newsworthy, it's what goes viral on the internet. And so you had, for the Republicans, what went viral on the internet were the embarrassing moments. They were Clint Eastwood with the chair. They were Paul Ryan giving a speech which was pretty much serialized from the beginning to the end. And for people eating breakfast, that's not cereal as in Kellogg's. That's as in one right after the other, right after the other. For the Democrats, you had, you know, Bill Clinton giving a phenomenal speech, Michelle Obama giving a speech that moved a lot of people, and so forth.
Even
and
those, Patty Murray.
Even Patty Murray. And I can't remember it right now, but she actually had a priceless line that is like, really, Patty Murray said that? She's not really known for her humor. So those were the things that got attention, because it's really more a matter of YouTube at this point than it is a matter of what CNN or the broadcast networks or Fox decides is newsworthy. And you know, some politicians seem to have caught up on that, some haven't. The other thing that happened this week, which didn't get very much attention because most of the political reporters in the country who cover such things were all in Charlotte listening to speeches, is the Romney campaign made a strategic decision with its super PAC money, and of course most people are under the impression they have an enormous amount of super PAC money. They pulled out their TV buys and spending in the states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, which are three of the key swing states where they were expected to spend a lot of money. Now, there's two possible interpretations for that. One is that they've got internal polling, and this matches some external polling that's been done, that says the chances of Romney winning any of those states are not very great at this point, and so they want to spend their money other places where they think they can get the electoral votes. The other possibility, which seems less likely, is that they are, in fact, short on money. But there are, because there are so few undecided voters in this cycle, at least according to all the different polls, there aren't that many swing states, and there aren't that many electoral votes that are truly up for grabs. Washington State, of course, you know, it's pretty inconceivable that Romney is going to win here unless he wins everywhere, and there are a lot of states like that. So at this point, there are maybe a dozen at most swing states left that are seriously up for grabs, and not that many large ones. Florida is really the only one that has a ton of electoral votes. Ohio also, although that's trending toward Obama as well. And so really, of the remaining swing states, Romney would have to win all of them in order to get to a majority of electoral votes. So when you hear pundits and news coverage saying, well, the polls are pretty even nationwide, that's more or less true depending on the poll you're paying attention to, but that's not how presidential races are decided. They're decided by number of electoral votes, and so that's a meaningless metric. The way you look at how a presidential campaign is going is looking who it would win each state, the aggregation of the state level polls.
And so far it's not looking good for Romney.
No, Obama's been over 300. He needs, I believe, 273 to win. He's been over 300 all year long, and his margin of width on some of the statewide polls that might shift has been steadily increasing over the past couple of months. And Romney did not get the kind of bounce out of his convention that a challenger usually gets. Usually a challenger gets more of a boost from a convention than an incumbent does when a challenger is running against incumbent, because people are less familiar with the challenger and they want to find out more about him. Mm-hmm. Well, not that many people, according to the polls anyway, were newly enthusiastic about Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan after the convention. We don't really have the polls yet on the Democratic convention and the impact that it might have, but that's not going to change the course of the election for Romney. Really, his best shot at this point is the idea that he has an enormous amount of money from all of the corporate backers and billionaires and super PACs that are going to pour an unprecedented amount of money into TV ads in the last few weeks of the campaign in the next month or two. And, you know, if they're pulling ads out of key states at this point, that suggests that that's not a strategy that's going to swing it for them anywhere. So at this point, Obama, you know, it's no point for Obama supporters to get comfortable yet or cocky, but he's in a very good position right now. And for people in Washington State, and we'll talk about this when we get closer to the election, where Obama really does have Washington State sewn up, it means, you know, you can vote your conscience. If you think Obama should be a president, great. If you don't think you object to some of the things that he's done because, you know, whether it's civil liberties or prosecuting foreign wars or not holding Wall Street accountable and so forth, and there are a couple of third-party progressive candidates running this time who are very good, you can vote for them and it's not going to affect the overall outcome of the election. So, it's becoming a less competitive presidential campaign, but national political media has a built-in incentive not to tell you that.
They haven't got the memo yet.
Well, they're not going to tell you the memo because, the more viewers and readers they have, if people think the election's going to be close.
And in the meantime, we get them trying to make it into, kind of falsely trying to make it into a horse race. And this week in the economic news, they've been focused on the jobs report and saying, well, this is bad news for Obama, et cetera, et cetera. Well, really, this jobs report that they're talking about is really not a whole lot different from the jobs reports we've been getting month to month throughout the year. January and February looked good, and the rest of the year has looked about the same as it has this past month. So it's really not much change. What I really want to talk about when I talk about the economy this week is the USDA issued a report on hunger that really shows the depth of the downturn. A total of 18 million households in the U.S. in 2011 struggled to get enough food to feed themselves. 3.9 million of those homes had children in them. That's about 10% of all families in the United States. That's a really significant percentage. 6.8 million of those households were considered very food insecure. That means they didn't just lack enough food, they lacked enough to get basic nutrition. It wasn't just that they were feeling hungry from time to time, is that they lacked the nutrients to keep alive and to keep healthy. The food insecure, those who just lacked enough food, that's about 5% of all U.S. households, a pretty significant number. Here's another little statistic, almost half of the people who are on the food stamp program are children. So that in itself
should get a job.
and
really, when you talked about the national media treating things like the jobs report as horse race fodder, talking about how it affects Obama's reelection chances, what they're not talking about is the real people who are genuinely suffering as a result of policies of, frankly, both the Democrats and the Republicans. Those people are becoming invisible while they talk about is the election.
I think these people are mostly suffering from the policies that the Republicans have put into place, particularly their inability and their unwillingness to negotiate funding for social programs and for anything that would stimulate the economy, any kind of infrastructure spending that would provide jobs or that would stimulate the economy, that would bring money into state coffers via tax revenue that would allow states to turn around and use that money for social programs and to feed people. Also, this week, too, there was another very interesting report. The Institute of Medicine released a study of waste in the U.S. healthcare system. And what they found is that about 30 cents of every dollar spent in the U.S. healthcare system is completely and entirely wasted. That's comes up to a total of, in their conservative estimate, about $750 billion a year. And just to put that amount into perspective, that's about equal to 10 years of the Medicare cuts that are in the new new Healthcare Reform Act that was passed recently. That's also more than the Pentagon's budget, and it's way more than it would cost to cover all the uninsured people in the United States. Now, they found six major areas of waste. The largest, by far, more than double any other, was unnecessary services. That means providing unneeded or duplicate diagnostic tests, for example.
I thought you were referring to the health insurance industry.
No, that's something they didn't look at, and I'm sure if you added in that completely unnecessary layer of the U.S. healthcare system, that $750 billion would look like pennies in comparison. Now, I just want to point out that of the six major areas of waste that they found, unnecessary services made up the biggest chunk. And that's when you start talking about duplicate tests and unnecessary diagnostic procedures and so forth, that's when you start hearing conservatives and right-wingers scream about rationing. And about how, oh no, you can't take away our healthcare system and give me socialized medicine, because then I won't have access to all the stuff I need, including all this stuff that causes so much waste in the healthcare system.
All right. And New York Times coming out coverage?
Yeah, this week the New York Times ran a headline on Tuesday, and I'll just read that headline for you. It said, quote, study, quote, questions, advantages of organic meat and produce. So essentially they were reporting on a Stanford University study that reviewed a selected group of other studies comparing organic produce with conventional produce. And
let me guess, they were very carefully selected.
Yeah, and of course the New York Times led with two of the conclusions of the study, that organic produce was no more nutritious than conventional produce, and that organic meats were no less likely to be contaminated with E. coli. But if you read a little further down into the article, you found that wasn't necessarily true. Organics are less likely to have pesticide residue than conventional. 38% of conventional foods have pesticide residue on them versus 7% of organics. Organic meat is less likely to be contaminated with antibiotic-resistant bacteria, which, according to the World Health Organization, is one of the leading threats to human health worldwide. The persistence and the emergence of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, particularly because of antibiotics fed to animals, and that organic milk had more omega-3 fatty acids. Yes, that's right. It's more nutritious. That organic produce contained more phenols, which are cancer-fighting nutrients. Yes, again, organic food is more nutritious. And that kids who ate organic food had fewer traces of pesticides in their urine. And as we know from other studies, three studies that were published last year, higher exposure to pesticides in children can affect their IQ levels, according to Columbia University, UC Berkeley, and the Mount Sinai Hospital in Manhattan. Now, I found that kind of interesting that the New York Times led with a title saying, oh, you know, there's no difference between organics and conventional foods, and yet the bulk of the article was devoted to proving that organics really are superior.
And we saw this with pink slime. We've seen it with several other things, too, where the sort of industrial food industry has really been doing concerted PR campaigns to try and push back against this notion that their products might have any problem with them. And they're getting a lot of cooperation from elite national media.
Mm-hmm. All right, very quickly, international, Desmond Tutu.
Yeah, Desmond Tutu, after withdrawing from a South African conference due to the presence of Tony Blair at that conference, came out for the first time this week and called for war crimes charges in the International Criminal Court against Bush and Blair
for their
launching of the war in Iraq. Iraq, according to Tutu, destabilized and polarized the world to a greater extent than any other conflict in history. Those responsible for the suffering and loss of life should be treading the same path as some of their African and Asian peers who've been made to answer for their actions in The Hague. The ICC has only been in existence for 10 years, and in that time has only had four prosecutions. All of those have been for African leaders in Sudan, Congo, Libya, and Ivory Coast, and there are some fairly obvious political reasons for that, so that, you know, there hasn't been a whole lot of really serious discussion of prosecuting Bush and Blair for this. Maria was mentioned, we were talking about this off the air, the real impact of that is that it's going to make Bush and Blair's travels abroad more difficult and presumably give them a little bit less credibility when they try to, in the case of Tony Blair, for example, pass themselves off as peacemakers in the Middle East.
Okay, and very quickly, Afghanistan.
Yeah, the U.S. announced that it was suspending a training program for Afghan militias. A lot of Americans are not aware that U.S. troops are there are training Afghan militias. We think that they're training the National Army and the National Police because that's what the Pentagon keeps telling us. But no, this is what are called local police and Afghan special forces. These are guys that are referred to inside of Afghanistan as Arbakai or militia. These guys have been responsible, and Afghan civilians have been producing the proof that these militias in rural areas of Afghanistan have engaged in mass killings. In other words, the U.S. has been training death squads in Afghanistan. The U.S. used the excuse to suspend the program temporarily because they thought that these militias might be a source of green-on-blue attacks, which is not true. The green-on-blue attacks have been coming, I believe, mostly from the National Army and the police forces. But they're suspending the program ostensibly to check the backgrounds of these militia members, but I think it's mostly to respond to Afghan civilian outrage.
And we should, just for context, when this happened in Iraq and there was a lot of negative publicity about the U.S. sponsorship of death squads there, they did restart the program just under a different name and very quietly later, and they will do that here too.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And you can find some of my work at mariatomchick.com.